It's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.
Farmers are amazing. This is a really good area for farming.
Your odds of getting a good meal in a random place in this country are a lot better than they were.
I can't think of a better place to spend a Saturday than in a restaurant, and sitting in a booth and talking to a chef that has a vision and has a perspective on farm to table, and he's living one of those dreams too. And I want to welcome Jose Salazar to Farm to Table Talk. Jose, thank you. You're doing some exciting things here in Cincinnati.
Well, thank you. I'm liking Cincinnati, and I think there's a lot of people doing cool stuff, and I'm just part of that wave.
Well, getting on that wave of doing cool stuff.
Yeah.
You started in New York, did you?
Yeah, I grew up in New York. A lot of my formative years in restaurants were in New York City. I worked for free for a little bit at John George, made some connections, and my goal was always to work for the best, therefore learn from the best. So then I went on to work for folks like Jeffrey Zakarian, who's now an Iron Chef and a very, very famous chef in his own right. I worked for Thomas Keller at Per Se, who was part of the opening team there. So I made it a point to try to get my way in, get my foot in the door in all the best spots.
I have listeners that know some of those spots you're talking about.
Yeah.
But I also have a lot of farmers and people around the country and people that know good food when they see it and enjoy a restaurant, but they don't know what's going on in the kitchen. So when you're getting started and you're working in the kitchen, would you describe like what kind of where you were in the stations, or do you work all levels? Do you work in the, you know, the salads or the plating, or when you're getting started, where do you start?
I mean, typically you can imagine, you know, the old adage, you start peeling potatoes, and that's pretty much true. I mean, you start out doing the grunt work, and it could be peeling potatoes, it could be cleaning, you know, 30 pounds of mushrooms or turning artichokes, or, you know, usually a lot of vegetable work. They don't let you touch the expensive meats and fish until you're maybe a little more skilled and adept with a knife. But I mean, if you don't screw up the potatoes, then they give you the artichokes. If you don't screw up the artichokes, then they give you the mushrooms and so on and so on. And you work your way up, and ultimately, you make the salads and you learn how to season things. And once you understand balance and salt and acid and all those things, then, you know, maybe they'll let you actually touch a frying pan. So it could be a year or two before you even cook anything in a professional kitchen.
You know, I'm smiling because I had a podcast not too long ago with Jeremiah Tower that had stars.
Wonderful chef, yeah.
But you know what's interesting? He helped put together this dinner where there was like 850 people, and he had three or four of the other top young chefs in Sacramento that were helping put this together. And so after he got everything going, he went over and said, "What else can I do?" And he started peeling vegetables and chopping, and he was... They kept him out there in the kitchen. You know? Nobody thinks Jeremiah Tower would be back there chopping up vegetables, but he was doing it.
You know what? I mean, that's a sign of a true chef, you know, someone who really just loves the craft. You'll hear that from a lot of people, I think. You know, the ones who really, really enjoy kitchen work, there's nothing disgrace in saying, "Hey, I want to peel a potato," or, you know, because... And also, we find solace in some of that work that just kind of is a little monotonous, but it kind of helps you. You almost develop this Zen sort of feel when you're, you know, on your own, just kind of you and a potato peeler kind of going at it.
We had another guest who was talking about that with working on pea pods.
Yeah.
And had the same kind of feeling.
Yeah.
That sounds boring.
But it's super relaxing. And again, if you love the food, you know, there's, I don't know, it's every time I peel a potato, I think I could do it better. I could do this faster, a little more efficient, less waste, you know. And I think it goes back to the love of just the craft.
Now, in addition to working and learning that way, did you get any additional training? Did you go to one of the culinary schools?
I did go to a culinary school. No longer in existence. It was called the New York Restaurant School, and it was in downtown Manhattan. Relatively small school. I think I graduated in... Oh, man, I was actually due to graduate right around September 11th. And so I actually never technically never graduated because we were right down near the World Trade Center, the school was, and ended up canceling classes for the last week or two, and ended up cooking for all the rescue workers. So,
well, you know, that brings one of the best meals I ever had in New York years ago. Before that, was at the top. What they call it, the top of the world.
Top of the world, yeah,
yeah. Was it Ferdinand Metz or?
Oh, you know, I don't know.
The chef,
I don't remember who was running it.
You know, it's fantastic. I mean, but that was a turning point for so many people. You know, when that happened. Now, you were still in the city, though. You're still in New York.
Oh yeah.
How long did it take that you were working in these other kitchens before you realize that what you really want to do is have your own restaurant?
Well, you know, I think everyone who starts cooking or gets in this business after a couple of years, you there's some way in the back of your mind you go, you know, maybe someday I'll have my own. Mm-hmm. But I made a conscious decision to not rush that because I was very aware of how difficult and how unsuccessful a lot of people are who get into this business. This is a super, super competitive. The failure rate is very, very high. Yeah. So I actually was maybe, I had a couple opportunities, you know, years before I actually opened my own to do it. And I said, no, I don't think I'm ready. You know, I kind of wanted to make sure that I had a little more experience and was a little bit better informed, so that I didn't fail right off the bat, you know. Mm-hmm. And even, you know, with that, it was a huge learning curve. I knew how to cook, but I was not a businessman, and I didn't know how to run a business, and that took me a couple of years to figure out.
We'll talk about the business a little bit, but first I want to go back. While you're still in the kitchen, when did you start recognizing how important the ingredients were? Was there a certain chef or mentor that was drawn attention to the importance of the sourcing?
Yeah, again, going back to the places I worked at, and they were all places that had those ethos. And I recall my very first week at John George. It was the peak of the summer, and I was, you know, I wasn't even aware of how fortunate I was to show up at that time of the year. But the very first week, this farmer comes in and, you know, probably a quarter inch of dirt on his fingers still, you know, had just harvested a bunch of stuff. And he's bringing mushrooms that he foraged on his land and these beautiful potatoes and tomatoes and all these things that, you know, I think to everyone who was there was commonplace. But to me as a youngish cook, because I got a little bit of a later start, but as a new cook, as somebody just starting out, I was in awe, and I didn't really understand fully the connection between the farmer and the chef until that day, and then it became very apparent that it wasn't like you know, just going out to the grocery store and buying, you know, some out of season stuff. It was all about what are we going to, you know, do, letting the farmers dictate what you're going to do, as opposed to writing a menu and trying to go out and source all this stuff from halfway across the world, potentially.
And then also in New York, I've gone down there before, but I've gone to Union Square and the farmers market down there, and I just bump into all the chefs.
Yeah.
I mean, they're just everybody's out kind of roaming around, checking it out. So they got stuff coming to the restaurants directly, and then they're out themselves kind of going on through the farmers market, picking up some other stuff.
I was fortunate to work in a restaurant that was right down the block.
And, oh, where was that?
It was called 15 East. And so we would go to the market, you know, at least once or twice a week to shop for ingredients, and it was amazing. Yeah, it was inspiring.
So you were kind of right at that stage, though, that everybody was recognizing, you know, the importance of the farmers. I'm wondering whether it was a generation before that some of these chefs were.
I think it was a generation before for sure, and a lot of the generation before trained in Europe, you know, in France in particular. A lot of the chefs made their treks out to France, and the culture there, I think, is that, I mean, farm to table was just the way it was. You know, that's a term that I think a lot of French people laugh at, because that's just the way they cook. That's they always went to the market. They always cooked what was in season. That's been their philosophy for generations and centuries. So I think a lot of the Thomas Kellers and the John George and those guys, that's just the way they trained. So certainly they were a part of the movement and helped, you know, spread the word throughout the states about, you know, how important it is to use local and seasonal. Those places that I was at, that was just sort of the way it was.
Now, so the farmers would let them know what they had, and then when they put the menu together, they build it from what was fresh and available?
Pretty much, yeah. And at Per Se in particular, the menu was written every night. We would write the menu the night before.
Yeah.
For the next day.
I've talked to some others that do that. This is crazy because after you work so hard,
yeah,
and here you know you're in here before your restaurant opens, and you work so hard, and then like 11 o'clock at night or something, you know, you're getting emails and texts and everything from the farmers, and you're still putting that menu together for the next day.
Right, right, right. Yeah, and so that's a little extreme. I don't think a lot of restaurants do that. You know, I think Thomas Keller's kind of an extremist in a good way. Yes, letting the farmers kind of dictate. And so we, you know, we are in constant contact with the farms, and then they'll tell us what's coming down the pipe, and we can write our menus or kind of plan. And then, of course, sometimes it doesn't work out. You know, weather really rapidly, and so what they thought they might have, they don't. But you know, that's just part of the deal.
When you're ramping up, how do you tap into that farm network? How do you identify the farmers
area? Great question. Because when I moved here 10 years ago, it was a good hour a day trying to get in contact with the different farmers, if not more. And in the last couple of years, there's been a woman who put together a co-op.
Actually, I did a podcast with her.
Alice
Chalmers.
Chalmers, yes.
Yeah.
And she has really changed the game for us because we no longer need to text and call and email every farmer.
Yeah.
And she does that for us, and she sends us an email twice a week, and we're able to go on her app and select what we need, and she delivers it. So she handles a lot of the logistics, and it's made it, I mean, 1,000 times easier for us to source good product.
And you know, you're in here in Cincinnati, and I'm in California a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And there we've got a lot longer season than you do here in Cincinnati.
Yeah.
So how do you balance out? I mean, you don't have all these fresh vegetables you need in December, January, and February.
Sure. So a very Midwestern thing is to preserve for the cold season. So we cure things, we pickle things, we freeze.
We can.
Tomatoes in particular are one of the things that we make it a point to can. And freezers. So we try to, you know, extend the season as much as we can via all those different techniques.
Well, tell me a little bit more about choosing Cincinnati. And you were in New York, and there's a whole world. You wouldn't have to limit yourself to the United States. Even.
Right.
So,
right.
So how did Cincinnati end up getting the nod?
So Cincinnati chose me. My wife and I had our son 10 years ago, and that's right around the time we moved. And our son was maybe 3-4 months old, and one night we just kind of turned to each other and said, why don't we leave? Why don't we go somewhere else? But her and I both grew up in New York and had never lived anywhere else, and so the idea of moving was kind of strange, and we didn't even know where to begin. You know, we didn't know much of the country. So started sending some resumes out on the East Coast, thinking we'd stay somewhere relatively close to family and still be able to drive back. And a headhunter got a hold of my resume and called me and proceeded to tell me about a job where I would be the executive chef, a job that I hadn't had the pleasure of doing yet. And it sounded very enticing, and he rattled off all the benefits and all the things that, you know, that he thought I would enjoy about the job. And after this 20-minute conversation, he says, but I want to tell you that it's in Cincinnati, Ohio. And I say, oh, well, no, thanks, but no thanks. No offense to Cincinnati. I said, I just don't know much about it, and I don't know anyone in that part of the country, and I can't imagine living there. So thanks, but appreciate it. And he proceeded to call back a few more times, and he convinced me to come out and do a tasting, and the rest is history. So that's 10 years ago, and I really didn't think I'd be here more than 3 or 4. And
so now your son's like, what, third grade?
Yeah, he's in fifth grade.
Fifth grade, yeah. Fifth grade.
So okay. he was an infant, and now he's in fifth grade. So
yeah.
Time flies.
Yeah. So when you get out here and you're working here, then and you decide to open a restaurant, that's no easy thing. Yeah.
Not at all.
What comes first? I mean, do you have the concepts, or do you start looking for real estate?
So the first thing was looking for a space.
Right.
And my thought is always let the space kind of dictate what mm-hmm. kind of. Well, you get a certain vibe, I think, even when it's raw. I think mm-hmm. you can kind of say this would fit here or wouldn't fit here. And the space that we found and could afford was this little tiny 1,200 square foot kind of bistro-y sort of feel to the space. And in fact, the contractor said, "There's no way you can fit a restaurant here. There's no way you're not gonna get a kitchen. It's impossible." Well, I said, "Well, you know, I think we can make it happen." And I said, "And coming from New York, I've seen a lot tighter." I said, "I think if you really go back and
right.
look at it a little closer, we can make it happen." And again, it had some of the bones of a bistro. So I said, "Well, I think we'll do some sort of a bistro, but." Maybe a modern sort of interpretation of that and really using local and seasonal ingredients. Mm-hmm. And again, kind of going back to where in France, that's just the way it is. And so I didn't necessarily look at it as a farm to table restaurant, but I said, you know, we're going to use really good products that are in season and the menu is going to be a little bit eclectic and not your traditional French bistro, but we're going to have some of the same ethos and philosophies of a French bistro. And yeah, sure enough, we made it all fit and got the doors open.
And it's the one where Salazar's is open now.
Yeah.
That was the original.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's in an area called Over the Rhine. And
yes.
For people that aren't mm-hmm. familiar with Cincinnati, mm-hmm. it's kind of a recovered area. They've been kind of rough.
Right.
And that's really cool.
Yeah.
But I don't even 10 years ago, it might still have been kind of borderline.
It was very borderline. And even 5 years ago when we opened up, our block, it's kind of a big alley almost. This mm-hmm. Republic Street is the name of the street, and the street lamps were damaged, some of them. We were the only ones on the block. There was a few condos being rehabbed, but we were the only business on the block, and it was still pretty rough, and we got broken into a couple times, and there was, you know, still a lot of unsavory characters hanging out around the building. But again, that was all we could afford. You know, we were maybe 2 years ahead of where everyone else, you know, came in, but that made it a lot more affordable for us to get in there. So we were kind of pioneers on that block. There was a lot of other folks already in Over the Rhine, but in some of the blocks that were a little bit more developed, and we were kind of off on our own in this little alleyway, essentially.
And then how long before you opened the second restaurant then?
So it was about a year and a half into Salazar, we started developing Mita's. So it was kind of almost back to back.
And Mita's, you're right in the center, down mm-hmm. in kind of the old traditional area, across the street from a Hilton and a Saks Fifth Avenue.
Right. This
and
is what
really nice big space.
Yeah.
With lots of light.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally different. So again, I said, well, what do I think would fit here? And I also, you know, not just in the space itself, but, you know, in the city,
right.
what's lacking. As so again, I try to think about the space, but also, you know, how it fits in the context of everything else going on in the city. Spanish and Latin American food is something that I had never cooked, and I like to challenge myself. I don't like the monotony or having something that just comes too easy. So even though my culture is, I'm from a Colombian family, I cooked in these French and Italian and, very sort of European influenced restaurants. And I wanted to bring something to Cincinnati that was a little bit different. But I had to go out and teach myself how to cook this food. So I traveled a little bit and I called family back in Colombia and I got some recipes and I started tinkering and tweaking and it was really fun, but it was a lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
But I managed to do a pretty good job of learning how to do this.
Well, it's a beautiful space. I really like it's nice and bright and open. It's very different. Your other space is really, really
totally different. Totally different.
Like exactly opposite.
But again, the space. I think the space being so different. The other one is small and intimate, and it kind of lended itself to that sort of decor. And this one being, the ceilings are, I think, about 30 feet tall, and there's these huge windows, and so it wanted something a little bit more grand, but at the same time I didn't want it to be stuffy or too fancy. I wanted it to be a place that felt comfortable.
So did you hire a designer?
Yeah, we hired MSA Architects, who also did the design work, and they we've worked with them on both our spaces, and they've been wonderful to work with.
Well, describe the menus. What do you have on the menu here?
Sure, so the menu here is tapas. Primarily, we do have a couple of big plates, the paella being one of them. It's kind of our signature dish. So again, it's Spanish and Latin American, and so we take influence from and again, I could have made it a Colombian restaurant, but I didn't want to pigeonhole myself because I knew I'd get bored. I'd get tired of cooking the same type of cuisine over and over again. So I said, if I go Spain / Latin America, Latin America is so there's so many different dishes that we can draw inspiration from. And so it's not very traditional per se. It's kind of our take on, say, ceviche from Peru. It's our our interpretation of it. It's, the paella is pretty traditional, but we tweak it a little bit. We have something like a pozole verde, which is a traditional Mexican dish, but instead of doing it with chicken or pork like they normally would do it, we do it with seafood. So it's a lighter, more sort of fresh version of that dish. Even some North African flavors. And then you'll see we take some of the influence that's in South America of the Chinese and Japanese immigrants that have made their way there. So the chifa and the Neki cuisine of Peru in particular. So we'll have things like an egg roll on our menu, but it's got some ají amarillo, which are these beautiful chili peppers from Peru that, kind of, again, tie in the Latin thing. So it's a little surprising for some people. They come in and they go, why do you have fried rice or egg rolls on your menu? And so we have to kind of explain a little bit, but it's fun. It's fun for us, the cooks, to be able to step out from your traditional Spanish or Latin.
Do you ever come across something that it's hard to find the vegetable?
And you tell
a farmer, hey, could you grow this for me?
Yeah, absolutely. We have. And in some cases it's been very successful, and in some cases it doesn't work because certain things just don't do all that well here. Or the farmers haven't, because it's something that you've asked them to do, they might not have the knowledge on how to grow that particular thing. So the first thing that comes to mind is padrón peppers, which are these beautiful peppers from Spain, and we love them, and we were able to get them in very small quantities. So we said to a couple of the farmers, can you grow them for us? And they were more than happy to do it, but for whatever reason they came out. Each farmer that we gave this task to, when they grew them, they were super spicy, way, way, way spicy. And if you're familiar with the peppers, 1 in 7 or 10 can have some heat, which is kind of cool because it's kind of like roulette, right, with the peppers. But they were all like, it was 10 in 10 were spicy. So for whatever reason, the farmers couldn't even explain. They said, you know, they came out way too spicy. So there's an example of,
yeah,
you know, an ingredient that we've not been able to source. So we substitute shishito peppers, which are a Japanese varietal, but they're very similar. So, you know, we work with what we can.
That's interesting. So, but then the other thing, it gets the farmers into trying some new things and trying some new vegetables knowing that they're producing something for you.
Yeah.
Do you find that your customers, do they know the difference and that you have got a farmer relationship?
Oh, yeah, I think so. I think the dining public here is definitely aware of that, and they are supportive of those restaurants that do go out and work with the farmers, because they know that the flavor, the end product is usually a little better.
Mm-hmm. Now, in a community like this, and in fact, we've also talked about the fact that there are communities around the country that you didn't used to think of being food centers that are exciting things are happening.
Absolutely.
I mean, Cincinnati is a big metro area. The population of the city limits may not be that large, but the metro is nearly 2 million in the whole metro area. But there are, you know, several dozen areas of like that around the country, and it just seems like they all are getting this idea, following a, kind of the trail that you've been on now.
Right. Yeah. And I don't know what comes first, the chicken or the egg, in the sense that, you know, does the chef or the farmer sort of drive that? But I can say from a chef's perspective, it used to be, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago, if you wanted to make your way as a chef in the United States, you had to be in one of these larger markets.
Like New York.
You had to be in New York or Chicago or LA or San Francisco.
Right.
And what happened is a lot of the chefs that, you know, I happened to have grown up in New York, so just by default made my way in New York. But say you were a chef or an aspiring chef or a cook in Kansas City, and you wanted to make your way and own your own place or be a great chef, you had to go to a bigger city. You know, there was almost no room for growth in the sense of just building yourself up in a market like Kansas City. So you'd go to Chicago, you'd get all these skills and develop a name for yourself, and then you'd go back to your city, right, and then, you know,
right,
be able to open up your own place and develop get some recognition. Now it's not that way anymore. A, because so many more farmers and so many more outlets to be able to source from. Also, you don't have to go. You can train under someone that is great and doing great things in your own city, and you don't have to travel to another larger market to be able to do that. And then also the people in your community are more, I think, open and educated and willing to try new things. So
when you hit a town, like you were just told me, you were just at some conference down in Louisville.
Yeah.
Do you look around a little bit and see what's happening on the scene?
Yeah, absolutely. I think every chef, you know, if they tell you they're not looking at what their peers are doing, they're lying to you, because, I mean, you want to see what's going on, you know?
Well, so what I think, I get excited when I hear you talk like that, is that knowing that around every time you get a chef, you get a restaurant, you get seven or eight of them going in these different markets, and each one of them have got, maybe they're helping 30, 40, or 50 farmers that many times were, they didn't have scale, they weren't able to provide Sysco with a couple truckloads of things, and they're able to make a livelihood too. The local economy ends up benefiting from it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, we have, you know, again, a lot of relationships with the farmers, but some of them have become friends, and it's great to see them, you know, grow and be able to sustain and feed their families and just be successful business people.
You know, and money's always an issue. I mean, because if you've got a really nice property here, you've got to have a certain plate price to be able to recover it.
Yeah.
The farmer's doing something special. You got to pay them more, probably, oftentimes.
Yeah.
To get the specialty vegetables.
Yeah, typically, I'd say
it's a tug.
It is, for sure. Yeah.
And yet, you know, one other thing that I've noticed, it seems like millennials are prioritizing good food. Maybe they're not getting rich, but they'll go out and have a couple good meals a week because they really love it. They appreciate it.
Exactly.
And and they'll assign some more value to it. So
absolutely. So I think that goes back to my previous comment where, you know, maybe 10 or 15, 20 years ago, it was a lot harder for us chefs to be able to get people to come out and try those things or to pay the premium price for those.
So when you look down the road the next 10 years and you're out here, you've got two restaurants going, what makes you the most optimistic or hopeful about the future?
Well, you know, it's hard to predict the future. I would think that we're going to continue to see growth. You know, there's always some growing pains. And I think one of the biggest challenges for us is staffing and finding quality people to work in our industry. So, you know, I'm very optimistic in that we'll get over that hump and we'll be able to train and educate people to work in our industry. But overall, I'm very hopeful, and I think that it's only getting better, and people are talent level in our city and in the country as a whole is getting better. So, you know, we're all pushing each other to be better.
Well, and as you do it, there's, again, probably as we speak, there's a few more restaurants opening up. but beyond these really nice restaurants that are opening up, it's also seeing that the fast food chains and everybody else are feeling compelled to identify the farming practices.
Mm-hmm.
So they may be getting large scale or getting commodities delivered to them.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you're into providing leadership to the broad scale, and all the supermarkets are putting stories up about where their food is sourced too.
Yeah, absolutely. It's great. And, you know, while as a business owner, I don't want to see anyone fail, you know, those who aren't necessarily investing as much effort and aren't as conscious of, you know, where they're sourcing from, I think people are starting to see through that. And so some of these, you know, maybe the chains or those folks are struggling a little bit. And so maybe they have to, correct what they're doing. And again, I don't want them to fail, but it's what it's doing is it's kind of lifting everyone up. Your odds of getting a good meal in a random place in this country are a lot better than they were 10 or 15 years
ago. Hey, and that's a good thing, and you've contributed a lot to it. And Jose Salazar, I really appreciate you taking the time because you're busy as chef and owner of Mita's and Salazar. If people, if they're not in this area, we have listeners all over the country.
Yeah.
How do they find you online to be able to see your restaurants or reservations or whatever?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'd say go to our websites, salazarcincinnati.com or mitas.co. .co. And then, of course, you know, we're on Facebook and Instagram and all that, and those are good avenues as well to find us. But yeah, we would hope they stop in when they're in town.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson. If you like what you hear, go to farmtotabletalk.com and follow us on Facebook and Twitter, or go to iTunes to subscribe and give us a review and a rating. Thanks for listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.